Thank you, thank you. I really appreciated going on the tour today. The most important thing I learned is that Butch Davies will never be my PR person. But certainly, I think for our particular region, and I'm sure that you are seeing this all over the Commonwealth, when you look at the relationship we have between Lynchburg and our surrounding counties, how important that relationship is, and how looking at things regionally can really do so much for an area. I have kidded with some of you on the tour today about, I will say to a gentleman, how difficult your job may be, and all of you have turned to me and said how difficult my job actually is. And the truth is, I think we all know how important transportation is as an issue here in Virginia. The realities of what we're facing and helping to educate decision makers as well as the public about those realities. And I know we're looking at the maintenance deficits. We're looking at federal funding and perhaps what that future looks like. We're looking at the lack of construction dollars, leaving money at the federal government, the 18.4 cents we pay in federal gas tax perhaps going to other states if we don't face the truth. And I just thank you for all that you do. I serve on the Transportation Committee, and I welcome any thoughts or suggestions to me personally, but also to our my colleagues, so that we can do a better job. I say a lot to Mr. Ken White, you have to help make me smart. So anyway, thank you for today. Thank you for being here, and welcome to Lynchburg and Central Virginia.
Mud Mountain someplace.
Davis said anything to get a little attention.
Oh, boy.
Delegate Valentine, thank you so much for joining us, and you're welcome and accompanying the CTV tour today.
Thank you very much.
while we're waiting, excuse me, for the audio version, because we do have to tape this, I'd like to say while the bus tour was underway, I went on a little walking tour of Lynchburg and was so impressed. It's probably been about 10 years since I walked through the downtown, and the city has made some very significant strides. And I was thinking about some of the smaller cities in Virginia that have done so much, and some of it through the things that we do here on this board. Think about the town of Abingdon without the Creeper Trail and without the enhancement projects. Think about this city without the enhancement projects. Look at what they've done in downtown Stanton with the resurgence there, and a lot of it is just building up a solid business climate. But we've been able to contribute to those efforts here on this board, and I think it's a great reminder just to get out and walk around, whether it's on a bus tour or looking for a good chili dog here in downtown Lynchburg. So, I think we can be proud of our work on that score. Just turn to me. All right. How's that? Excellent.
I'll answer.
Yeah, just keep the line down. I think we're all here just fine. All right, we have a very busy and important agenda today, and the first item on the work session is the transfer of maintenance responsibility for the RMA, and Tom Hawthorne, Richmond District Administrator, is presenting. Welcome, Mr. Hawthorne.
Thank you.
Currently, VDOT maintains, does routine maintenance on the Richmond Metropolitan Expressway system, has been doing so since the early 70s when the road was completed. I'll give you a little bit of background on this issue, but the action that the board will be requested to make at the May meeting will be to rescind the 1972 Highway Commission resolution authorizing VDOT to provide that maintenance service. A little background information. Section 33.1288 of the Code of Virginia grants the CPB discretionary authority to provide aid to certain toll roads in Virginia. And that's a section of code that was the implementing section back in the early 70s. The State Highway Commission, by resolution dated August 17, 1972, approved the performance of routine maintenance on the Richmond Metropolitan Authority Expressway system subject to certain conditions. First, aid shall consist of actual maintenance of the expressway system exclusive to the Boulevard Bridge as segments of the road are open to traffic. Aid shall be limited to ordinary maintenance activities as defined in the VDOT Activity Code Manual and to pavement markings. And those ordinary maintenance activities that have been provided to the Downtown Expressway and Powhite Parkway, examples are pothole patching, sweeping, snow removal, litter pickup, lighting repair, the mowing, the general day-to-day ongoing activities that are necessary on any particular roadway. The Richmond Metropolitan Authority has since that time been responsible for any major rehabilitation or major repairs to their facilities and have been doing so actively since the road opened up. And as the last bullet suggests, aid shall not include other maintenance replacement activities nor any cost incurred from toll collection expenses. So this is truly, the activities have been truly those of a routine maintenance nature. VDOT has provided those maintenance services since the road opened up in the early 1970s. We currently provide that maintenance service through our turnkey asset management or maintenance service contract through Virginia Maintenance Services at an approximate cost of about $495,000 per year. Reasons for action. Terminating the maintenance on the RMA facilities will be consistent with current policy. There's been a conscious move over the past years to remove the subsidies that have been provided to both private and to public toll roads in Virginia. The RMA is one of the last remaining ones with a public subsidy given to it. Some examples of recent actions. The Dulles Toll Road has historically funded all debt service, operations, maintenance, as well as major toll improvements and mass transit support, so it's self-sufficient. The George P. Coleman Bridge, which is a VDOT toll facility, the commuter toll was increased in 2005 from 50 to 85 cents to fully cover all obligations, including ordinary maintenance, and to begin funding reserves for major maintenance. The Powhite Parkway extension, which is just to the west of the Powhite Parkway and RMA's facility, still requires a subsidy. That is a VDOT-owned toll facility. It still requires a subsidy because those revenues are just beginning to come back since the completion of Route 288, which took a fair amount of traffic away from it. The Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel received its last assistance in this current fiscal year. As far as the private toll roads are concerned, there's no state aid provided to those facilities, and those are the Chesapeake Expressway, Pocahontas Parkway, and Dulles Greenway. Those annual savings from not doing maintenance activity on the RMA would be put back into the state maintenance budget. Here's a map of the Richmond Metropolitan Authority Expressway System. The road is in two segments, shown in orange on the map. You have Interstate 95 is over on the right-hand side of the page where the Downtown Expressway connects to. The Powhite Parkway crosses the James River on the left-hand side of the page, and the gray roadway in the middle that you see connecting the two orange lines is Interstate 195, which has always been a VDOT maintenance responsibility. So that gives you a little perspective of the the extent of the roadway that we're talking about. And then finally, the action requested is to rescind the 1972 State Highway Commission resolution to discontinue VDOT funding and performance of maintenance activities on the RMA expressway system. And that action would be effective July 1st, 2008, as proposed.
Questions?
Just for clarification, how long, how many lane miles is engaged in this section?
I don't have that number off the top of my head, so I won't guess, but I'm not going to guess. It's not an extensive number of lane miles. It's a four-lane or six-lane facility through most of it, and overall length is probably 5 miles, so somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 or so.
Thank you.
Ms. Martin? So if I understand correctly, if we rescind this, then the responsibility for the $500,000 goes back to the toll road authority itself?
Yes, sir. They would be responsible for providing maintenance for their facility.
Okay, and they are operating at the point where they have that surplus now?
The RMA just recently voted to increase their toll, their toll rates on the Downtown Expressway and Poway Parkway effective in October of this year. And they went into that, they made that decision knowing that this action was likely or would be coming.
Ms. McCarthy, did you want to, sit both on the Commonwealth Transportation Board and the Richmond Metropolitan Authority, no one better qualified to address this issue.
Well, thank you for that kind interpretation of my role, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. This idea did not originate in the district. And I can tell you, as your representative to the RMA board, they are not happy campers about this. I think they see it as inevitable. Sooner or later. They've had a good working relationship with Tom and his staff for 35 years. There's a little quid pro quo involved in that VDOT does this routine maintenance, and the RMA lets VDOT store material and equipment on some of their property, which they're so annoyed that they're going to talk to y'all about leasing it to you now, which I can't imagine. Tom and I talked about this. I can't imagine it'd be all that much money, but it's, I guess they've had a good working relationship, gentleman's agreement, for decades, and they are not happy, and I'm sorry that we have to do this. I'll probably even vote against it just as a matter of principle, because I'm not sure why we're doing this. I understand consistency, but there's different kinds of consistency, and the difference between this and a couple of the other roads you mentioned are substantial. For the RMA, this represents something close to 8-9% of their maintenance budget. It is a big hit, and one of the justifications for raising the tolls last month was because they had to anticipate that the state was going to do this, and therefore they have to find an extra $500,000 a year on average. Sometimes it's more. A lot of times, if it doesn't snow, it's less. It's only when it snows that it gets expensive. But $500,000 is a good average. So I find myself in an unusual circumstance here, Mr. Chairman, that but I would be less than candid if I didn't represent the RMA board's thoughts about this. We just had a meeting yesterday, and the general manager asked me to make sure that everyone understood that they were not happy campers about this.
Thank you, Mr. McCarthy. And the chair would observe we've been pursuing this as a matter of policy as we're discussing maintenance deficits. We have done a similar thing with the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel, which was equally and probably on a percentage basis even more painful for that facility. Pocahontas Parkway, a private facility, we had been subsidized. And that was part of the restructuring of that. The Coleman Bridge, those of you on the board remember that painful exercise of raising the tolls in that district. The fact of the matter is maintenance dollars are dear, and when we make a promise that something and that was not the case in RMA, but most of these facilities have been built as not burdening the transportation trust fund. And that's true in the early lives of a toll facility operation, but over time they're very significant. If you add up those five or six toll facilities, you're looking at several $1 million a year of subsidy from the highway maintenance operating fund to toll facilities. And so where we are with a maintenance deficit, this is a very prudent a policy and one that will benefit the entire state as well. And as Mr. Hawthorne indicated, this is the last of these transitions, which are difficult. And I will certainly acknowledge that. But we've been through this in other parts of the Commonwealth as well. Mr. Kuhlman.
Mr. Chairman, would you characterize that a process actually of discussion with the General Assembly members, say, from the Richmond District, from Hampton Roads District, that they've been made aware of these steps and as necessary and proper? Have you had those conversations, or has someone?
I would say probably they're aware of it. They may not be aware of it as a statewide policy. And so, for example, in the case of the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel, there was actually Appropriation Act language to make that clear. In the case of Coleman Bridge, when that toll increase came up 3 years ago now, that was debated in the General Assembly, and we explained the mechanics of it. So I think it's probably the case that individual legislators know it on their individual facilities, but probably not as a policy basis, and that's probably a good idea to say what we're doing as part of overall measures to pull down our overall annual maintenance costs, maintenance and operations costs. Any other questions or comments? Thank you, Mr. Hawthorne. We'll see this on the May agenda for action. The next item on the agenda is the passenger rail update. Mr. Kevin Page at DRPT. Mr. Tucker, did you want to make any introductions?
I think this has been an ongoing theme for us to keep the board apprised of our efforts on the passenger rail as well as the state rail plan. As you all are aware, we're going to be developing a rail plan document by July and coming back to submit to the General Assembly by September a resource allocation plan. And so what Kevin is presenting on today sort of reflects a lot of the work that we're doing to sort of set the stage and the work that we've done even prior to that to sort of help us get a better understanding of where rail will make sense and how we should look at it from a perspective of what lies today. So much of Kevin's presentation that you're going to hear is going to be informative for the board in terms of gaining an understanding of operations that occur throughout the state of Virginia from Amtrak point of view and some discussion about VRE operations as well to sort of give you some context.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Tucker, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Good afternoon. As Matt indicated, we're moving forward today with a presentation to help bring the board to a more informed status on intercity passenger rail in Virginia and also as Amtrak operates as the national transportation network of intercity service. Before you is the intercity service map for Amtrak for the United States, and respectfully, the next slide brings us forward to indicate and show that from the Eastern Seaboard's perspective, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, the state of Virginia actually has every Eastern Atlantic route that branches out and goes southward as far over as New Orleans that actually comes through the Commonwealth. We have 21 Amtrak stations here in Virginia, and we have 8 service routes that are provided as intercity and regional service by Amtrak on a daily basis and 3 days a week through the Cardinal out to Chicago. Now, for the next 8 slides, I'm going to go through these services briefly. For the members of the board, the format is under span of service. We've tried to give you an opportunity to see what the span of service is and also provide detailed routing information. I will, from a higher level, go through these slides, but if any member of the board has questions about any information on these slides, I'll be happy to digress and better explain. The auto train service is provided by Amtrak. It started back in the 1970s as the auto train, which was a privately operated inner city service. This is truly a service where we can say we're taking cars off the road because the auto train is exactly what it is. It's a train where you put your automobile in the back of that train and you take it to Sanford, Florida from Wharton, Virginia. In addition to that, this is touted to be the longest inner city passenger train in the world. On a good day, this train runs up to a distance of about a mile in length and has had excellent service in providing getting automobiles off the road. This train operates at a 55% level of performance. It leaves daily from Gordon, Virginia at 4 p.m. and has a 9:30 a.m. arrival. It has a very strong ridership for an interline service, running and operating at about 299 riders per day. The next route I want to talk about is the Cardinal route, and I'll digress for just a minute to say that this is the only three-day-a-week service that we have in Virginia. However, it is also the only service that we have that actually provides service to the western part of the state. This route actually uses one of our short-line rail partners, Buckingham Branch Railroad, for about 116 miles. And as this board may recall, the Commonwealth Transportation Board has made investments through DRPT for the enhancement of passenger rail for the continued existence of the Cardinal service. And I may note to the board that currently today, this train operates at an 18% level of on-time performance. This train passes its counterpart that comes from Chicago on the Buckingham Branch Railroad, and any improvements that we can make to that rail line for the efficiency of operations are very good, not only for passenger, but for freight services as well. The Carolinian route is a route that's subsidized by North Carolina DOT. It's what we call purchased regional intercity passenger rail service. This service runs through Virginia, has a 27% on-time performance. Not all of that is attributed to Virginia, but it is a pretty dismal performance for state service. This is a daily service that's provided in a window in Virginia from 11 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. It's two trains, one north and south a day. It operates 365 days a year, and in Virginia has 91 riders. The Crescent route has the highest level of on-time performance of the intercity routes that carry just passengers at 68%. The Crescent operates daily from New York to New Orleans and operates on Norfolk Southern primarily its entire route. Matter of fact, solely its entire route, just south of where it operates for about 5.5 miles of CSX, just out of Union Station. This ridership is pretty robust. It's at 614 riders outside of Virginia, 92 riders a day inside Virginia. For an intercity train, that's about the norm for that area. Our Palmetto route is an eastern seaboard route. Unlike the Florida trains, it does not go into Florida. It turns back at Savannah. This route itself operates at 55% level of on-time performance. It's a 10 a.m. and 7 p.m. window of operations through Virginia. And the Palmetto offers what Amtrak refers to as a business class service. For Amtrak, that means that you have a reservation opportunity on this train for business class riders that ride from station to station. It's not exactly the business class that we're looking for in Virginia, but I think either myself or Mr. Tucker might want to comment on that a little bit later in the presentation. The regional routing of trains, what they call the Northeast Corridor Regional trains, from Newport News, Virginia to Boston, Massachusetts, is one of our highest ridership opportunities. It only operates at a 60% level of on-time performance. These are four trains a day that operate, two out of Newport News and two round trips out of Richmond, that operate on what we call the Crescent Corridor, or the line section from Newport News, Richmond, and on to Washington, D.C. In Virginia alone, this is 616 riders per day on the only four trains that run round trip. Two of these trains offer round trip service out of Main Street Station, Williamsburg, and Newport News. The Silver Meteor route is one of two of the Florida trains that runs to all the way down to Miami. This is a 55% level of on-time performance. It averages about 30 riders per day. Again, it's a long-distance train operating from New York City all the way to Miami. The Silver Star, its counterpart, operates over to Tampa, follows generally the route of the old Seaboard Airlines. This train operates at a 55% level of on-time performance, pulls about 49 riders per day in Virginia, with the remaining line share of the riders coming from other areas along the line. I'd like to talk respectfully a little bit about the Virginia Railway Express and give the board just an overview of what VRE does with its 30 trains it operates on a five-day operating week. As we all know, VRE is a commuter rail operation that's designed for commuter rail services. And it's also designed to take cars off the road, particularly in Northern Virginia in its ridership area. It's a 250-day-a-year operation. 5:05 a.m. is when the first train rolls out, and the last train rolls into the terminal at 8:10 p.m.
14 days per train days operate on the Fredericksburg line, and 16 trains per day operate on the Manassas line, and also use the CSX right-of-way to get into from Alexandria to Union Station. Ridership on VRE, as we've reported in the past to this board, has been on the decline, primarily due to on-time performance and other challenges that VRE has had. Last operating year, they still had a decline at 13,540 annual riders. On the Fredericksburg line, they had 7,170 riders per day and 6,370 on the Manassas line per day. Respectfully, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, the last quarter of VRE is on the uptick. It's experienced a 4.2% increase in ridership. A substantial amount of that is attributed on part to CSX and VRE and Amtrak and DRPT coming together to work collaboratively to improve the on-time performance, and also investments made by both VRE and this Commonwealth Transportation Board to help refleet the VRE equipment that's currently in operations today. 11 cab cars have been purchased and put into service, and 50 coaches, what they call gallery cars, which are double-deckers, are on order or in the process of being delivered to refleet the VRE service. For calendar year 2007, VRE experienced an 88.37% on-time performance. 06 was their absolute worst year of 81.52% on-time performance. In spring of 2007, Matt Tucker and I actually went and met with Alex Cumont, president of Amtrak. And in this meeting, we discussed bringing forward Amtrak as a partner with Virginia to help develop and enhance intercity passenger operations in the Commonwealth. As a result of that meeting and several dialogues thereafter, Amtrak has come forward to the Commonwealth of Virginia with a short-term action plan to work to advance passenger rail in the Commonwealth of Virginia on a short-term action plan basis by going and looking at all of the existing Amtrak corridors that had service today, and then coming forward with a plan and a proposal that would bring forth two scheduled routing proposals that would provide us a quick turnaround, short-term action where we could see intercity passenger rail service enhanced on existing corridors that had a utility for growth and ridership and service opportunities. That short-term action plan looked at all of our intercity rail in Virginia, as I've said. Coming forth from Amtrak were two routes identified, one in the I-95 rail corridor, primarily CSX, and another in the I-66-29 transportation corridor, which is operated on Norfolk Southern right-of-way. Provided in this report were also refined ridership, cost, and subsidy estimates helped to us and brought to us by Amtrak as they would as if they were costing out this service to do on their own. Both of these service proposals also included the trains operating through to New York City. That's very important for us here in Virginia because we want to offer a business class service that's not only dependable and reliable, but also have run-through opportunities for Virginia's citizens to go to New York as well. The short-term proposal came forward with the Newport News leg from Newport News to Washington, D.C. and onward to New York City. This proposal of the two had the highest potential for rail ridership, as the identified corridor being that of the Crescent Corridor that I mentioned just a few minutes ago. This service would begin in Newport News every morning. It'd be a seven-day-a-week service. 6:45 a.m. would be the departure and a 4 p.m. arrival back, departure from Washington, D.C. This service also, as it's proposed by Amtrak, will be what I call a reverse commute option. You could actually live in Newport News and work in the city of Richmond, get off Main Street Station about 8 o'clock, and then turn around in the afternoon and ride home early evening trip home to arrive back in Newport News by 8:25 p.m. Just respectfully, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, in this quarter there are 616 riders per day. This train, by adding an additional frequency of service in this quarter, would bring another 139 new riders per day to the rail environment and help bring automobiles off of Virginia's highway systems. With an approximate travel time of 4.5 hours, we would see this this service implemented at a subsidy cost of $1.7 million per year. This ridership and subsidy estimate comes in at around 50% recovery through the fare box, fare returns, which is very strong for intercity passenger service and shows the ability of this service to have great utility for future growth. The short-term action plan proposal for the I-66 US-29 corridor came forward from Amtrak with adding an additional train from Lynchburg, Virginia, all the way to Washington, D.C. Several times over, the Department of Rail Public Transportation has studied this corridor in addition to others to Southwest Virginia. And this corridor section, particularly between Charlottesville and Washington, D.C., had the greatest ridership opportunity and utility for additional service. The addition to coming further south to Lynchburg is brought about by the ability and opportunity to turn the train and actually store it at the Lynchburg train station, which gives us a greater opportunity for ease in operations of train movements and overnight storage. This proposal also, like the Richmond proposal, would provide what we have defined as business class train service, an estimated initial ridership of 91 per day. As you may recall, earlier in the Crescent, we're looking at 86 per day in the quarter as well, so this will be 91 additional riders. So we'll double the ridership in the quarter as it's provided today in intercity service. It's a 3.5 hour service time in each direction and was designed to provide the greatest opportunity for Charlottesville, being a 6:13 departure in the morning and a 7:09 arrival in the afternoon, early evening. That again gives some commuter opportunities as well for as well as midday meetings in Washington, D.C. This service as well came in at around a 50% recovery on the fare, $1.9 million per year. And we have to also look as well respectfully at the Richmond-Newport News corridor. We had existing opportunities for train sets, but we did not have the opportunity before us for the $61 million plus that we would be looking at as a cost to the Newport News corridor. Our host railroad improvements would be minor on this line comparative to the Richmond-Newport News line in Washington as well, but the subsidy here would be around $1.9 million per year. Key challenges continue to be before us as we go to develop passenger rail in Virginia. Reliability and scheduling is first and foremost as we move forward in the development of our plans and proposals that we will bring forward as part of the state rail plan process. Our primary focus must be on improving reliability. We don't want to pay for service that's not reliable. Virginia has set an extremely high goal of 95% level of on-time performance. If we're going to get service, we want to get good service, especially when we're paying for it. Amtrak will work with Virginia to develop a performance and implementation plan based on that theory and premise, as well as Amtrak service of on-time performance in Virginia, respectfully, as I mentioned earlier, is between 18 and 68%, but yet the overall average for Amtrak service in Virginia is not a very strong 43% for 2007. So we want to bring this bar up higher to a 95% on-time performance, at least in the quarters that we're implementing service. VRE's on-time performance in the I-95 corridor has improved dramatically over many issues that have been addressed between CSX, VRE, and Amtrak. It was 75.3% in 2006, and it's improved to 85.5% in 2007.
Is that primarily attributed to the bridge at Quantico?
Quantico Creek Bridge, and we also had that what they call the heat restrictions in the summertime due to track buckling and movement due to the extreme heat conditions and track conditions. CSX put $30 million over the past 3 years into an extensive time surface program to assist in what they call hardening the roadbed, which means restabilizing the roadbed, and the conflicts of the Quantico Creek Bridge, as you mentioned, have also increased the efficiency of train operations in the corridor. Amtrak service, notable, is not designed for Virginia's commuter needs. We need to make sure that both trains do operate during a peak time for services that we're designing. And right now, as you saw in the operating windows, we do not have exactly the best peak time services available today for the riders in the areas that we're trying to target. So that's a point of emphasis for us as we move ahead. I want to just brief the board on rail funding to date. These are initiatives that have begun as far back as 2000. The Commonwealth, through its mass transit program, has been supporting VRE at the tune of $84 million in the past 6 years. And that's for both capital and operating improvements for its services in the NS and CSX corridors. The Rail Enhancement Fund has a total project investment both ongoing and planned through 2014 of $396 million. Those significant improvements include freight rail improvements of about $155 million, passenger rail improvements of about $73 million, and also, as you'll see respectfully, through the Rail Enhancement Program, over this same 10-year time, we're reserving $169 million for rail projects that are brought about through the state rail plan. It is notable, however, that we will not have enough funds to pay for all of the needs in Virginia. One project alone, that is the Crescent Corridor project, totals more than $800 million in project needs. The VTA 2000, as this board may recall, in the General Assembly's Acts of 2000, provided $81.6 million that was designated for passenger and freight rail improvements in Virginia. $6.7 million was earmarked of those funds for the Eastern Shore Railroad, and about $75 million was set out for passenger rail improvements in the I-95 and also the US 2981 corridors. Onward to state rail plan and funding. Infrastructure needs, as I mentioned, will exceed available state funds. Private, state, local, and federal investment is going to be key, a key component to the way we develop this plan and implement these programs. Passenger rail requires a subsidy, as most passenger operations do. Ridership fares cover about 30% of VRE expenses, with the other 70% remaining for federal, state, and local subsidies from the partners that are involved in this operation. On September 30th of 2008, through the Appropriation Act, we will be providing a resource allocation report and recommendations to the General Assembly. That report recommendation will be constrained, but will likely include federal and private funding as part of that strategy that will be laid out and brought forth. The schedule, Mr. Chairman and members of the board, we began our rail plan development for rail planning in February of this year. April, we gave a presentation to the CPB on the US 29 quarter, which is today. And during the summer, we will present the draft document to the CPB of the state rail plan, which we have a 30-day comment window, and also publish the final plan following that. With September 30th, as I mentioned earlier, will be our resource allocation report that we will be bringing back to the Commonwealth Transportation Board and the respective committees of the General Assembly as required. At this point, I'd like to turn the floor back over to you, Mr. Chairman, to answer any questions or any comments Mr. Tucker may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did want to make a couple of comments. First, I'd like to keep in mind that with the entire presentation that Kevin gave, all of the rail lines that Kevin spoke about are privately owned rail facilities. That's a very important note for us. The other aspect that goes along with it, which is a very positive impact, is that record amount of freight have been moved on rail. One of the things that I do take note of along the corridor, or the Newport News corridor, CSX is actually adding additional freight capacity, freight cars, actually due to increased coal traffic. And I received a very similar letter from Norfolk Southern a couple of weeks ago saying that they were experiencing that same dynamic of significantly increased traffic as a result of coal and intermodal activity. That's very important for us to note. When you think of operating on those facilities with passenger rail, understand that to the private sector, capacity represents a commodity. And the capital improvements on one side of it are expensive. I mean, just to build the infrastructure so that you both can operate is expensive. But still, we have to keep in mind that the capacity that they have on their railroad is a commodity, and passenger rail is not valued at the same level a freight rail car would be valued. From my past experience in California, I always tell people when I think and talk about rail that you really have to make sure that you make wise strategic investments. And I'll say this so the Secretary will remember this forever. The difference between bus and rail is very simple. When you make a mistake with the bus stop, with the bus line, you know what you do? You pick up the signs and you walk away from it. When you make a mistake with the rail line, you operate. Okay? So we have to make sure that we get it right. One major note from my perspective is that when we engage in a discussion of passenger rail, in the Commonwealth of Virginia, the first discussion has to begin with on-time performance. To me, my personal business belief is we should not operate any service until we can comfortably tell folks that if you get on this train, you're going to get there on time. It's not going to be perfect, but the numbers that we talked about just a moment ago, ranging, I think, up to 68% was the best line, and the average was in the 40s. It's just not acceptable if you really are going to anticipate folks making a decision that on faith I'm going to get out of my car and I'm going to get on this train. You've got to get the numbers up in the high 80s and, from my perspective, the high 90s. right now, the service that's out there today is, from my perspective, is not designed to meet commuter needs. So when you look at the services that I've heard folks talk about in Virginia, you are talking about expanded service. And again, one of the points that Kevin identified was that it requires an operating subsidy. And I'll tell you, my experience has ranged in terms of operating subsidies for railroads. I've seen subsidies on light rail system, the one that I operated in Santa Clara, the fare box recovery ratio was 7 to 10%, one of the lowest in the United States. I've seen fare box recovery for heavy rail and metro at some points in time were close to fully recovering its cost for operations. And typically with the commuter rail system, you're going to range right around 30% if you're doing pretty well, and some of the dynamics that we identified in terms of additional train service along the 95 pointed to 50%, which is a really good performing passenger rail, but nonetheless requires an operating subsidy. So as we move forward, I just want to give the board the level of comfort that we're going to move very cautiously, conservatively, and diligently, because I think that the worst thing that we could do is bring forward a program or a plan that says we can do everything because we can't, and that everything makes sense because it won't. It's going to be, like all transportation projects, a matter of choices.
Mr. White.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kevin, if you can go back to slides 15 and 14, maybe. Yeah, 15 is the one that I've received the most interest from my district. I'd like for you to comment, maybe Matt would too, on the financial analysis here. Both slides refer to host railroad improvements. In one case, they're minor, in the other case, they're major. Did this report, this proposal from Amtrak, address these railroad improvements?
No, sir, they did not. And that's part of where we're headed now on the next iterative process of the short-term action plan, is that we're actually working collaboratively with Amtrak and the host railroads to determine what those costs will be. When you say minor, you're talking about station facilities, storage track, and turning facilities versus another line that Matt mentioned just a few minutes ago where they're adding more coal trains. Obviously, the capacity may be more constrained than they are over here on the Lynchburg line, so therefore the cost could be significantly higher, Mr. White, on the other line. And that's why we need to at least put forth a conditioning statement to say that host railroads are working with us to identify those needs, but we don't have the final cost estimates at this time.
Do you have an estimated timeline on when those numbers will be available?
We're hoping within, Matt, if you like
we will have that information available by the timeline for the resource allocation plan. And one of the things I will note, that the issue of minor cost or minor improvements reflect Amtrak's perspective,
right,
and not the host railroad, not the owner of the railroad. They oftentimes have different points of view in terms of what is needed in terms of improvement. I think the fact of the matter is you look at the infrastructure along that corridor is in a better state of repair. But again, we're making significant investments in that corridor from a freight rail point of view, and that capacity that has been added is capacity that they're not going to give up. They're not going to say, we like you, Commonwealth, and you can have that capacity. So we're going to have to work through that issue in terms of what is the capacity that would need to be added so that we don't diminish their ability to move freight.
Well, if I understand that, then by the September 30 date of the resource allocation report, we will have numbers that are acceptable to Amtrak, but
right,
not necessarily acceptable to the host railroad.
No, we will have completed a discussion
with
both Norfolk Southern and Amtrak in terms of those of what the improvements would be.
Good. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, is our strategy to stay with the freight lines? Is that the long-term strategy?
I guess, do I take it to mean what have we looked at alternative rights of way of building our own separate rail line? The fact of the matter, we've done some looks at that. It is significantly much more expensive to do that. You have to understand the corridors we're talking about, as you know, are pretty developed corridors, and the cost of us building a new alignment between pick a point Lynchburg and D.C. or Richmond and D.C.
would be very cost prohibitive. It would not be a project that I would see that my kids would see happen.
So, further question. So what's the future here as the freight capacity becomes smaller and smaller?
No, is it, the bottom line of it is as you they're not the freight the host railroads, Norfolk Southern and CSX, bless you, are not going to let you add additional service without providing commensurate capacity. I think it was very unique, the VRE experience, in terms of CSX actually letting VRE operate prior to actually making the improvements. But what's worthy of notation is that within the embedded agreement that allowed VRE to operate is that a third track would be built at absolutely no cost to CSX. So it's a pretty significant discussion. It was pretty unusual. And I doubt any railroad today would allow you to have a deal where you began operations before you made the improvements.
Well, is that an option to build another track in their quarters? So
parts of it, if you recall back, go back to the third track report. We looked at where there was a sufficient width in the right-of-way to be able to add additional capacity. And the whole analysis we are doing is looking at if you can do that in certain segments, looking at where you may look at alternative alignments or different railroads to sort of separate freight and passenger rail traffic at certain points. So we are doing all of those types of analysis, because at the end of the day, we wanted reliability and cost.
Is there any numbers on the cost of building new rail lines compared to new lane miles?
Well, it's tough because every project is unique. I'll give a real bad example. A real bad example would be look at Norfolk Light Rail. It's about seven miles, 11 stations, and it's a $250 million project. If you look at a commuter rail project, what is it, Kevin, about $11 million per mile,
right,
for rail. But again, that doesn't get into all of the soil conditions, bridges, all the other special conditions. It's real hard. You have to look at each project on a project-by-project basis. But the costs that I've typically seen always are about 30 to 40 to 50 million and higher and higher. Very expensive endeavor.
Mr. Davis.
I was going to let my colleague go first. But I find this discussion fascinating, and it takes me back to the one in Roanoke and a couple others that we've had. If the truth be known, we're investing public funds in private railroads for minimal benefits that we've identified that we think make sense. We're not having any serious discussions about really offering substantial enhancement to rail, freight rail. We're not talking at all about any substantial enhancement to passenger rail. And we say to ourselves, it's too expensive for us to even talk about it. And yet, every public hearing that I attend in the Shenandoah Valley, the majority of the people who come to that hearing say, we want more freight rail, and we want passenger rail in the Shenandoah Valley. And I have said over and over in those public hearings when people would listen, if you really want that, are you willing to pay for it? And they say, how much will it cost? And I tell them, you don't really want to know. And that's not a very good posture for the Commonwealth to be in all candor. And somehow or another, we need, I think, to maybe pat ourselves on the back for working with the private sector to piddle with improving freight rail. But we would kid ourselves if we aren't honest with the public about passenger rail and put the numbers up there and say, if you really want passenger rail, this is what it's going to cost, and either step up to the plate or forget it. But we're in the middle of that, and I don't find it very comfortable if when I'm in those public hearings trying to answer the public on the issue. VDOT takes it on the chin every single time as if appearing to only want to do roads, when we won't tell them the truth and lay it out there. And I'd love to see us have the courage to lay it out for them one time, in one quarter at least, as to what could be done if we really wanted to do passenger rail, or if we wanted to substantially enhance freight rail. That would mean building a state-owned railroad to compete with those guys, much to their chagrin, and later privatize it and go back to the private sector. But those numbers are huge, too. And the staff has been very helpful in sharing with me just how big those numbers are. But I think we should put them out. That's my feeling.
Mr. Chairman, let me just establish this point. Obviously, public subsidies suggest that there's some value and return that's created elsewhere that makes it worthwhile in a broad sense as opposed to a specific sense. So I have a question about the subsidies per passenger here. There's quite a bit of difference between the subsidies per passenger that you would see from, for example, the Lynchburg to D.C. line versus the Newport News to D.C. line. You know, one's a quite a bit larger than the other, the Lynchburg line. On the other hand, I don't have a sense of what the subsidy per passenger would be, for example, for VRE, which has a much larger ridership, and I don't know what to compare it to, whether, not just that it's worth it dollar for dollar, but in a broad sense, what are the other benefits that are created by these lines that make it worthwhile doing? The second thing is to just point out how small the ridership is in total. It's less than 1,500 a day, and so we're dealing with a fairly discrete number of customers, if you will. I don't mean that negatively or positively. I just mean it's a pretty good targeted market. But are those other benefits that I mentioned, are those intuitive or are they quantifiable? Will they be in your rail plan, like, you know, congestion relieved off 95 or additional hours, you know, saved, or will all those things, how do you factor all that in, I guess?
I think, first of all, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, respect to Mr. Coulombe about VRE subsidy per rider versus intercity passenger rail per rider. With VRE, obviously, they have a greater turn and greater capacity on their trains, which makes the subsidy per rider go down. The challenge with an intercity passenger train is that you have that train that will go all the way into the corridor. Part of the reason the benefit, you know, you're asking about quantifying public benefits, we get a greater benefit to actually have that train go all the way to New York City because we get to share in the revenues and also the riders while they're in the Northeast Corridor because it's part of that train. So we have looked at to try to quantify the maximum amount of return that we could get out of our fare box recovery. In addition to that, for example, the Lynchburg service, we want to make sure that we had a service that we could set forth because today there's no real true interstate to Washington, D.C. So actually we're trying to put together a schedule and an on-time performance that can guarantee that a rider can have a travel time competitive from Charlottesville or Lynchburg to Washington, D.C. as well. I realize that when you look at the numbers, they don't look as robust as they may, but yet they look good compared to as they are benched with other intercity services of their type within the United States. So that's where I kind of fall out with your statement about subsidy as well. So we will be looking at, as we go forward for a more robust maturing of this plan, we've been going forward in the rail plan with service design guidelines and what we would be looking for in public benefits as well.
To answer your question, yeah, absolutely yes. We will be able to quantify all of the public benefits associated with providing more robust, more reliable passenger rail. And we're going to be doing work with Amtrak on the travel demand forecasting to really look at what the ridership would look like if you truly had much more reliable, much more frequent service. So we actually are going to lay out all of the costs. I think for the first time, we're actually engineering some of the costs of the improvements so that we'll be able to stand before the board and give you a much more reliable cost estimate for putting those improvements in place than we've done in the past, as well as the public benefits associated with it.
Follow up. I'd like to second what Dr. Davis has suggested as well, that this plan reflect a much more ambitious set of goals. The fact is we know the way energy prices are going, gasoline prices are going. We know the public's mind is turning to alternatives, and quite frankly, we don't have capacity to give them alternatives in this direction, and we should. I think there's a lot more people who would take advantage of this mode if it were more robust, if it were more ambitious, if they could not just rely on it, but they could actually rely on it.
Rely on it.
So ending is language great. But the final thing is, I have a question about, are these criteria the same to, they're not the same to evaluate intercity passenger versus commuter.
Yes, sir.
But do you use them the same way in terms of resource allocation? Like, you know, each $10 million increment investment can produce this type of return or this, or is it just apples and oranges?
They're similar but dissimilar in the same taking. You know, VRE is a commuter rail service, which is more like a mass transit operation. Put it simplistically. You know, they're partners that all come together as a part of that. But yet there needs to be a resource sharing from an intercity service where you're branching over to, say, 150 miles of distance. Obviously, you're not going to have the concentration of governmental bodies coming together with the resources because a lot of where we're running is through rural areas of Virginia. So therefore, you have to come forward with a resource allocation that shows where there's a sharing of both federal, state, and local resources. And through those strategies and how we will set up the service design criteria and the program implementation plan as to who should be responsible for what would be the outcome of where we're headed with that. You're going to find characteristically, you know, Northern Virginia, for example, has a local taxing authority for gasoline. We don't have those revenues on the inner city operation. So we're going to have to look more creatively as to how we go about with a strategy to help fund and put together all of the resources we can to make this happen.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you very much. I want to commend the department for getting going on this. I remember a year and a half ago, former Governor Holton was with us and delivered a rather impassioned, urgent plea to us regarding the 95 corridor in particular, but I think he encompassed a couple of other opportunities, and we promised him we would be delivering on that, and so I'm delighted to hear we're about to. I have a couple of observations that I hope will be constructive. One is, I won't take up time this afternoon, but I'd really like to talk to y'all about the language you use, because we make investments in freight rail, but we give subsidies to passenger rail, and it's the same money coming out of the same pot for the same return on investment or different returns, but for the same general purpose. So I'd like to level the language playing field here, because we're subsidizing freight rail as well as passenger rail, or we're investing in it, but we're not subsidizing one and investing in the other. So I'd like to get that consistent, since consistency seems to be a theme. Second, I do think it's very important that we do what Dr. Davis suggested, is lay it out. What will it cost? When you say, as I know you hate to say, but you say, you know, the numbers are really scary. Well, if you said that for the hot lanes 10 years ago on 495, yeah, the numbers are really scary. But we're leveraging state funds for that. We're not subsidizing that project. We're investing 400 and some odd million dollars in a whatever, I forgot how high the cost is, Mr. Secretary, but it's in the couple of billions or more. That doesn't scare us. Why should we let rail scare us? We don't let highways scare us one little bit. And I think we need to be consistent there, too, and be bold and to say, this is what it's going to require to do what we really think is necessary to deliver 90% on-time performance. Because right now, short of the state getting in the game somehow or another, I don't see how you could guarantee 85 or 95% passenger rail performance, because CSX still controls the rail. And I'm not saying they shouldn't control, I mean, they own it. You know, we're not going to tell them, sorry, we're condemning them and taking it over. We're not doing that. But if we want to do what we want to do, then we've got to face the music and say, folks, this is what it's going to cost. Are you willing to do it? And I agree with Doug's point about, it's really like that, you know, if you build it, they will come. I am convinced that the reason the numbers are so low is that the service is not that great and it sure as heck isn't reliable. And if we were able to add capacity and increase reliability, I know all kinds of people who say, I wish I could do that, but I just can't depend on it. And my livelihood depends on a certain level of reliability. So I think we ought to go for it. Lay it out, tell people what's involved, and be consistent in the way we describe it. If you look at it, it's really a public service that we're providing, whether it's in roads or airports or buses or passenger rail. It's all the same thing. We're trying to move people and goods around and through this Commonwealth and collect a fee for it in some fashion while we're at it. But we're not subsidizing one and investing in another. We're doing all the same sort of investing. And we, I think, at least the ones who've spoken, want to see a decent return on that and want to see some reliability in it. And we're willing to at least let the public know what it might cost to achieve those two objectives. So, thank you.
On the Amtrak proposals, for example, Newport News to Washington or Lynchburg to Washington, 30% of the fares cover about 30% of the cost. What kind of cost is it? What does a passenger pay per mile in paying that fare?
Mr. Bowie, I don't have the exact number for you, but I can provide it to you later and also provide you a copy of the proposal.
Can you say whether it's comparable to the cost of operating an automobile the same mileage or more or less?
I think especially in the Newport News corridor, it's comparable in studies that we've seen before. I just recently went from Richmond to New York myself and priced out car versus automobile travel versus my own travel, and it was equivalent.
It was cheaper. I just did it, too. It was $244.
You buy the tickets ahead of time where you don't get the rate uptick in the last couple of weeks. You're actually
cheaper. Yeah. You buy it 2 weeks ahead of time.
2 weeks ahead of time, you actually can. And it is competitive. Like I said earlier, our driving force is for reliable and car travel efficient and competitive transportation services.
One last question for me, Mr. Chairman. The required operating subsidy that we refer to in the two proposals, is that the state's share of the subsidy? Because you said federal, local, there's a number of places that happens.
The subsidy as it falls out, the way Amtrak operates today, statutorily, if it's state-funded service, it's service we've requested that they look at, any operating subsidy has to be borne by not Amtrak. So that can be a combination of state of Virginia, local, or other sources. It could be private sources for that matter.
At the risk of carrying this on, do we get a bigger bang for our buck with intercity rail or mass transit like rail?
That's how you one person.
That's an apples to oranges in a lot of ways.
Well, where I'm headed with that, where should our priority be? Is what I'm asking.
Well, that's a different question and a more important one. The last legislative session was about substantially increasing transit capital, operational funds, rail capital, and I think, to Mr. McCarthy's point, the term subsidy, really refers to the operational costs. And so the Rail Enhancement Fund, which we appropriate through this body, is about capital. The challenge is finding ongoing operational support. VREs has worked because localities are picking up roughly 60% of those operational costs. And, there's a question that I know Matt will be a little nervous about me raising here, but if we're going to pay operational costs, it's going to compete against those other transit providers. And everything is a fixed pot of money at some level. So we need to be, very... Capital investments are one thing, and we can evaluate those and get some hard numbers. But when you look at, operating assistance is probably a better term than subsidy. But that's going to be the challenge on transit and rail. And over the life of the project, the operational costs always vastly exceed the capital. And most of what we see here is the capital side of the equation. And so that's, again, as we get into this and we're going to continue to have briefings and discussions, I think is very important. Let me just mention a couple of observations, historical notes. The VRE was able to get into the passenger rail business because at that time the Commonwealth was the majority stockholder of preferred stock in RF&P. It does make a little bit of a difference. And at that time, railroads were still adjusting to a deregulated world. They were not the profitable entities where they were competing for space. So in the mid-1980s, it was a very, very different time for commuter rail service than what we have today. I think, too, some of the parallels as we think about our rail program is very much, and Mr. McCarthy's bringing up the Hotlink, I think, is a perfect parallel. That a hot lane facility, what we're trying to promote are those three people who choose to get into a car, the HOV performance, and that's what we're willing to put public dollars into. And, you know, some of the suggestions are to have a standalone lane, say, for bus and HOV within the hot lanes versus something that relies on technology and operations and better operations so that you move all cars as well as HOV and buses more efficiently. And that's when you talk about having a standalone passenger line, that's really kind of the parallel to that. And you can answer cost, operational characteristics of both on that, but I encourage you to think about these rail investments like we do as a PPTA. It is a negotiation with a private entity that has a bottom line they have to achieve. We have to know, and you ask the question, where do you get more bang for the buck? What bang are we trying to get? And we have to, it's our job to define and quantify what is that public benefit, and if we meet that threshold, by all means make that investment, make the commit to the operational assistance. But we don't go into it without knowing what is that public benefit that we're seeking. One question, Mr. Page, I guess intrigued by the, and I've not seen the statistic of the 43% on-time performance for the North Carolina state-supported service. Does the state of Carolina have performance measures? How do they react to that if they're putting state dollars into a multi-state service? Are they able to negotiate? What are the causes for the delays in that line? Are there things that they can do to enhance that performance so that they get bang for their buck?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Actually, the Carolinian operates at 27%. 43 is the average for Amtrak overall in Virginia. We're being very methodical to learn from the lessons of others. And what we're trying to do is we look respectfully at what North Carolina is experiencing. North Carolina owns their own railroad called the North Carolina Railroad that the Carolinian in part operates as. That railroad needed significant improvements and also capacity improvements as well. So capacity improvements are being made on that piece of railroad that's operated by Norfolk Southern by agreement. In addition to that, North Carolina DOT, Amtrak, and CSX, and DRPT through our modeling effort, our capacity modeling effort, are working to get an achievable 80% on-time performance on the Eastern Atlantic Corridor trains of Amtrak. As a part of that, North Carolina and Amtrak have identified improvements south of the Carolina border, which is Skipper South. That need to be made as well to help bring that on-time performance up. North Carolina has also committed to putting in state resources and investments in improving that railroad line to help increase that on-time performance.
So it's a function of capital?
It's a function of capital, and unfortunately, and I don't want to get into their operating agreement, but we are learning from their lessons of their operating agreement to make sure that we do have on-time performance as a component as part of the structure of our agreement.
Thank you, Ms. Page.
Thank you.
The next item on our agenda, again, having an important rail component, is the Route 29 status report from Dr. Mary Lynn Tischer. Will be presenting. Dr. Tischer.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and good afternoon, members of the board. I will be providing a status report on the Route 29 study, and the first slide that is forthcoming. Yes. All righty, thank you. Provides a context for the study. And as you can see, Route 29 goes through Maryland, D.C., Virginia, and on down to Florida. It changes its numbers a couple of different times, and it ends up going into Florida, being called again Route 29. And as you can see, it is a basic engine for the western Piedmont area of Virginia. And within Virginia, there are about 219 miles that go from the North Carolina border up to I-66 in Gainesville. The route itself was a component of the national highway system. It was also designated by Congress as one of the high priority corridors for interstate travel and the movement of goods. It serves long distance travel. It links three metropolitan areas, Danville, Charlottesville, Lynchburg, with the heavily commuting area of Northern Virginia. And it also carries large volumes of local traffic, which conflicts with the service, the through service in the corridor. And in addition to the highway, the Norfolk Southern provides rail service along the corridor. There have been several studies that have been performed over the years about the corridor. The green one there is was phase one of the Route 29 study. It was completed in the late 90s. The magenta was phase two and phase three, and that was completed in 2003. And there was a separate study that was done around I-66 in the early 2000 time period. As you know, there was a meeting on January 16th with members of the Commonwealth Transportation Board, with General Assembly members, and also local elected leaders. And at that meeting, there were several issues that were identified: congestion, concern about safety, the issue of throughput on the corridor, access control, land use and transportation planning, and the recognition that the local economies do indeed depend on the corridor. The same group of people identified a need to improve traffic operations, consider the rail alternative, while encouraging broad public input in the development of the recommendations for the corridor, and to build a local regional consensus on the ways to move forward. The study itself has a public focus on why the transportation corridor is important, how the corridor itself is used, and developing goals for the safe use of the corridor in the future. There are a large number of databases available, and they will have to be updated. In particular, the land uses along the corridor will need to be enlarged. As part of the analysis, the study will develop corridor performance standards, identify safety and congestion hotspots, look at the role of transit and other travel modes along the corridor, identify freight movement needs, and to look at access management and the development of access management plans. There is a short-term immediate action plan that would be required that would identify solutions for these critical safety hotspots, to identify commuter service enhancements, including enhancements for transit, for rail, and for other passenger services in the area, to recommend improvements for freight movements, recommending congestion mitigation solutions, and to develop access management plans. There would also be a requirement for interim corridor recommendations that would be for approximately 5 to 15 years, that would identify recommendations for those same issues into the future. And then lastly, there would be a development of a blueprint, which would be a multimodal vision plan for the entire corridor that would build on the commonalities of the citizens' concern along the corridor, but would be a balanced transportation system that includes highways, transit, and rail modes. That these recommendations would be developed in a context-sensitive way and be responsive to the environmental concerns along the corridor. The study itself is to be completed by November of 2009. The request for the proposal is on the street now, and it is anticipated that the proposals will be received approximately the end of the first week of May. We had a pre-bid conference with the proposers yesterday, and there were quite a number of people who were interested in at least talking about the study. We'll see how many decide that they will propose. And that is pretty much a summary of where we are at this point in time. I would, however, if I might, like to introduce Charlie Rasnick, who will be the contract manager, the day-to-day fellow on this project. and
perhaps to retirement.
He retired and has come back to work on this study specifically. And with that, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my remarks.
Mr. Chairman, I'm curious who the study is being done for, and what who is hoping to do something about the results of the study. I didn't understand it. Is this for CTV, or is it for?
This data is that there was very significant interest in the General Assembly, and so there, like any major corridor study, this will come back to the CTV. We have made a commitment, as we do in all major corridor studies, to keep the local elected officials and members of the General Assembly in the affected corridor area apprised of it. Now, one of the issues is anyone who lives or have been to some of these meetings, we have a north-south issue, and that's one of the issues that's going to have to be resolved. There are trying to get a handle on freight movements in the corridor, I think, is a very significant and important undertaking that really hasn't been done previously. But to answer your question, it comes back to us. And we do have some decisions during the tenure of this administration we have to make as to the future of the corridor.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to also characterize this as something that's a little bit new but certainly necessary in the way we think about things, the General Assembly thinks about things, and the department itself thinks about things. Clearly, this runs through four districts, Northern Virginia, Culpeper, Salem, and Lynchburg. It concerns at least two other at-large members directly in their from the jurisdictions and areas where they live. But more importantly, it's the beginning of looking at our system, as opposed to as the pieces of a puzzle. And if the other pieces don't get put in place, well, that's too bad for that part of the state. Fact is, this functions and increasingly will function as a statewide corridor. I mean, it's always been that, but we've divided it up so it's maintained separately. The construction and improvements are done separately. The local governments respond separately. The General Assembly doesn't respond. But in this case, by bringing it together, I think we widen out the view, we broaden the possibilities for creative solutions, and we potentially bring the solution out of the larger amount of resources and identify the identification of the common interests, as you said. So I think we're going to end up creating some solutions out of this study effort that just aren't possible district by district, budget by budget, region by region. I mean, this is a statewide corridor. I think it's going to provide a model for several others in the state as well. And if we don't actively defend and improve these, we're just going to lose them. And we can't afford to lose them because we can't afford to replace them. There's not another place to put another 29 to do what we need 29 to do. So I'm very encouraged by this. It's a collaborative effort, and I think it is going to be a new model for us as we move forward, both in terms of identifying solutions and revenues and allocations to support them.
Will the study attempt to quantify some of the costs associated with delivering the product or the desired desired road that we want or desired system that we want, so that we can do similar to what Mr. Davis has suggested, begin to lay some numbers out there, and as we talk about all these things and as we gather around six-year plans, it draws attention to our needs throughout the state, particularly in this corridor and other areas of the state, because, as you know, we face some very difficult decisions on the existing projects in a six-year plan. So I think all new improvements, as we study them, as we lay it out, we ought to put the numbers on it as well, and let the public have that up front so that they can be a part of the discussions moving forward, and then we can begin to look at our legislative group on how are we going to raise the money to do that. But will this study, the question was, will we begin to quantify anything here?
I think Dr. Tischer would say the starting point of the study, and if you recall the joint session with the state legislators, was we priced out very sketch-level estimates with billions that are required for, you know, some of the existing options on the table. And so that's one of the reasons to go back and rethink some of those pre-existing options.
I suspect what we'll find is there are a series of strategic investments, none of which we can afford, but some that we just got to do. We've got to find a way to do. Some of them may wind up being less bang than we're willing to put the bucks behind. And that's the importance of a study like this. I just also like to offer just editorial. You know, these last two presentations, you think about where we were 3-4 years ago. We're looking at dots on a map, and here we're talking about the 95 quarter. We're talking about the 20, you know, the 29 quarter. We're talking about major court. That's how we, and it's been a slow, sometimes painful evolution to bring the CTB to thinking about broad corridors multimodally. And I just want to acknowledge the work of staff and DRPT and VDOT. If you went to a meeting 5, 6, 7 years ago, that would not have been the case. And it's not always easy, and sometimes a little squishier than we would like. But this is how we have to think if we're going to, you know, get to a vision and then price that vision and then make the hard choices. And I'm sorry to editorialize. Mr. White.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I want to commend your leadership and the leadership of the commissioner on this project, because going back to what Mr. Coulombe said, if you look at that map, it sort of says it all. You know, the corridors through Virginia are few in number. We have I-95, which is clogged. We have I-81, which is clogged.
58.
And right through the center of the state, you have really the only other north-south way you can get from point A to point B.
Bypass, sir.
And if we don't do something now to preserve that corridor, it's going to be gone forever. And you made reference to maybe it's a north-south issue. I really don't view it that way. I'm from the south. And we're in the south at the moment. But I think the meeting that was convened by the secretary and the commissioner back in January, the comments around that table showed that there were concerns from virtually every locality. And they were almost saying the same things that we're saying here today. I remember two localities said, we need help. We need help now. We need somebody to save us from what we've been doing to this corridor. So I've got great, great expectations coming out of this process, and I'm glad to be working with Charlie Rasnick again. I'm glad he's still retired but still working.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman. Go ahead.
I'm just curious if our Hallowed Ground study is being coordinated with this in any way, because that whole study is also underway in fairly extensive form.
Yeah, Mr. Davis asked about the Hallowed Ground study, which is principally, but not exclusively, Route 15. And I know Dr. Tischer has worked with the Hallowed Ground folks, so to the degree there's overlap, obviously there would need to be that coordination.
Sort of the western edge of 29. All the way down that corridor.
Stops in Culpeper. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to pick up on what Ken White said. I think it's important that we started with legislators. The earlier study that you referred to as Phase 1, Phase 2, and 3 studies was actually an initiative that John Milliken, as Secretary, put together. Hell meetings, and it was broken into segments in an effort to develop that consensus. Meetings were held in the corridor. The problem was that the consultant took control of the process. When the presentation was made on the phase one study, they presented, here is the way the segments of your road are going to look. The presentations that were made, it received immediate negative response. The way we have started this is different from the way that project was approved. I'm hopeful that the consultant is going to reach out, as we have started doing, and gather that information, bring it in, and we find those areas on which we can reach consensus. That's a real challenge. On phase two and three, they reach consensus. The folks in Lynchburg, Danville, the legislators, they had a vision of what they wanted to accomplish, and when you ride on the Danville bypass and the Monroe Heights bypass, you find that both of those roads are part of that consensus they reached that came out of the phase two and three studies. So I guess my concern is that we make it very clear to those people who are interested in providing the work that a major part of their responsibility is to make sure that we develop some consensus as this moves forward. What I'm delighted with is that we started with that approach, and I appreciate the leadership that you've provided in making that happen.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Davies, that was certainly a focus of the discussion we had with the pre-bid conference offerers yesterday. And I do believe they understand the importance of the development of the consensus and the importance of Route 29, both in terms of the length of it and also, in one sense, the breadth of it. But I thank you for your comments and also your experience.
Any other questions of Dr. Tischer? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The next item on our agenda is the director's update on the Roanoke Regional Intermodal Facility. Welcome, Mr. Tucker.
No presentation. let me just remind the board about the Heartland Corridor project, if that's okay. As you recall, back in 2005, one of the priority projects that came out of the first allocation of rail enhancement funds was a project to make improvements along the 460 corridor. That 460 rail corridor is a corridor operated by Norfolk Southern Railroad. The entire purpose of the project was to remove tunnel obstructions so that you could double stack trains, increasing the amount of capacity. In Virginia, that involved us removing four obstructions, and it also involved the location of an intermodal facility in the Roanoke region. I will say the entire Heartland Corridor project was designated as a project of national significance. I think sometimes we all lose short sight of the fact that this project is beyond Virginia, West Virginia. It's really from rail operations from Hampton Roads all the way to Chicago, shaving off 1.5 days of travel time, increasing the capability of moving freight on rail. In terms of the project, primarily it did focus in on removing those obstructions. But within the project, there were three intermodal facilities. Intermodal facilities are essentially just transfer points between trucks and freight primarily, so that it allows you to move additional containers by freight rail rather than on the road. The significance of it for Virginia is that as we were actually developing the project, we received a request from the New River Valley and Roanoke region for us to specifically look to locate the intermodal facility within that region without respect to any jurisdiction. I think at this point, Mr. Secretary, I'll make a comment that you've said to me and over again, that this project, as well as the project that I spoke to you a couple of months ago, reference to Norfolk Southern, the improvements along the 66 corridor, really reflect the difficulty of expanding rail capacity because we're running into some of the same issues in terms of moving projects forward when we are looking at expanding it outside of the existing footprint of where the rail operates. So back to the whole discussion of the intermodal facility in the Roanoke region. We completed 16 months of study to determine what is the most feasible location for the intermodal facility in the Roanoke region. We had started out with 10 sites. All of the 10 sites had been identified by Norfolk Southern Railroad. We also solicited public input on additional sites. We did receive an additional site proposal from the city of Salem. I will tell you that the vast majority of our time over the last 14 to 16 months in terms of review of siting alternatives has focused in on making the Salem alternative work as a location for the intermodal facility. It was important, I think, that I mentioned some of the criteria that we identified in terms of siting the intermodal facility, and it's important because it relates to a lot of the corridor projects that we talk about meeting after meeting. The first one was proximity and good access to I-81. Now, that's an important note to take because if you recall our discussions back in November in Roanoke, we focused in on discussions of taking additional truck traffic off of Interstate 81. So the project is on the Heartland Corridor, Route 460. So we set a criteria where we wanted to be able to maximize the amount of trucks diverted off the road and containers moved by freight by saying one of the key criteria for locating the site is close proximity to 460 and 81. We also talked about it being located on the Heartland Corridor line west of the Shenandoah. We wanted to avoid new grade separations. As you all recall, we funded projects in the port area to sort of remove some of the grade crossings so that we could ensure that as we add freight capacity that we minimize the impact to the public and communities. We looked at the site criteria in terms of making sure that the land was available, that we looked at about approximately 65 acres, relatively flat land is needed for an intermodal facility. We wanted to minimize road construction and traffic impact. And we wanted to ensure, and this was something beyond what we wanted to ensure, NS wanted to guarantee that they would be able to efficiently operate their railroad. The other issue that we looked at very closely was the environmental impacts associated with the project. As I stated earlier, we vetted 10 sites, and we went out for additional public feedback, and we received a modified site proposal from the city of Salem. At the end of the day, our analysis concluded that only one site was a feasible location, and that was the Elliston site that's located in Montgomery County. Our findings on the Salem site were pretty simple in terms of why Norfolk Southern couldn't operate there. Basically, if you understand Norfolk Southern's railroad operations, there are three pieces of track out there. Two of those tracks are for east and westbound movement for intermodal operations, and then the third line was for coal operations. As a matter of locating the project in the city of Salem, we would be taking their rail operations down to essentially one track. The other issue that was associated with the Salem site was actually just a footprint. If you think about the city of Salem where the intermodal project was going to be located, it's pretty much developed. And as we looked at how do we mitigate the issues such as grade crossing, we identified a major grade crossing at Union Street that would have to be shut down between 4 to 6 hours per day if this project really hits the stride and produces the economic as well as the containers taken off the roads that we've expected to produce. And as a matter of doing that, we would have to separate the automobile traffic from the rail traffic, and that significantly increased the cost of the project. So you had a fatal flaw in terms of the ability of Norfolk Southern to operate, and the cost was significantly higher. It would range from $53 up to $72 million as a cost of doing that project. The Elliston site, on the other hand, provided met all of the criteria. The cost for doing the project was $35 million, and that's a fully built-out project. One of the key things that I wanted to mention, because as I was doing some additional research on this, is that I mentioned earlier that there were three intermodal facilities as part of the Heartland Corridor project. And it's worthy to take note, because if you recall, we released our economic impact and public benefit analysis back in January. And it said that approximately up to 2,900 jobs could be created, local tax revenue getting up to $71 million as a matter of the facility being located in the Roanoke region. And I was taking a look at the project that's planned for Pritchard, West Virginia. And that project has not moved into construction. It's a similar cost to our project. And their study found that up to $293 million in savings to shippers would be accrued over a 20-year time frame, and that the economic value of the project was $83 million for a project of similar size and scope as ours. Now, the biggest planned intermodal facility project on the Heartland Corridor is the Reichenbacher Intermodal Facility. It's actually an additional facility being built in Ohio to replace a facility, to supplement a facility that's actually reached its capacity. It's 300 acres. Now, compare that to the planned facility that we've talked about is 65 acres. The analysis on that project says 9,500 jobs will be created in 30 years. It says $800 million in local and state revenue would be generated as a matter of that project. And again, it points back to the reality that we already know. You look at the Inland Port Project, our Inland Port Project, 7,000 jobs created, $600 million in local investment. So for us, as we went through this project, in summary, we clearly tried to make the Salem site. Salem strongly supported the site, and we tried to make it work there. It couldn't work. And at the end of the day, the only feasible site was the site, the Elliston site, as originally identified by Norfolk Southern. But what's really important to note about this project is both the transportation and the economic benefits. One of the things I didn't mention was that 150,000 trucks or containers are committed to be carried as a matter of this project moving forward. And the commitment is that if it does not occur, all of our money that we're investing in this project will be paid back to the Commonwealth of Virginia plus interest. Back to you, Chair.
Questions?
What do we need to do to make it happen?
Well, let's talk about a little bit. Did you all receive a copy of the governor's letter? Was that forwarded to all of you? The governor sees this really as part of the extension of the port system. We have an inland port in Front Royal. There is one under development in Prince George County, and this would be the third. We would probably be the only, I suspect, certainly on the East Coast, the only state on the East Coast to have a network of intermodal facilities. And Mr. Davis, going back to your point, we got to think big. The Heartland Corridor doubles freight capacity in this corridor. This is a very significant undertaking, and actually, in the grand scheme of things, relatively cheap. If you look at it from a national perspective, it's about, what, $300
million? $250 million, $32 million is the Virginia share.
So there's a very good return on investment, whether it's saved maintenance costs, taking trucks off the highway. In the early days of the freight program, we didn't necessarily consider energy savings a public good because energy was a whole lot cheaper 4 or 5 years ago. Well, today it is. What we have to do by way of process, the governor wrote a letter to the local elected leadership who wrote to the governor 2 years ago and pledged their significant support to the location of an intermodal facility in the region. And it's our hope that the region, the state, and local elected officials will coalesce around a position in support of that. Like everything we do, this involves tough choices. I think there probably was a time when a lot of people said, well, let's not do highways, let's do rail, because it's not controversial. What we found in Dulles Rail, Norfolk Light Rail, Heartland Corridor, whether it's in Elliston or a couple weeks ago in Fauquier and Warren County, it's all controversial. And these are very, very strategic investments. And the governor and this administration, whether it's Transportation Secretary, Natural Resources, or Commerce and Trade, are trying to reach out to the affected communities and say, look, this is, if we want to be competitive, if you want your children and your grandchildren to live in a community which is globally competitive and have a state that can continue to support the system of higher education and K-12 we have today, these are the kinds of tough choices we have to make. So over the next, now about 21 days, we should be hearing back from the region. I believe there's a meeting scheduled
late this month.
On that, we would welcome the attendance of any board members if that's going to be.
Is this anything that local governments have? I mean, is there a zoning involved or anything like that?
There is not zoning control. Railroads under the Interstate Commerce Act are exempt from local zoning requirements. However, a preliminary finding of the Montgomery County Board is that they do oppose the siting of the project at this location.
And is this something that DRPT decides, or has this come to the CTB, or where? I mean, I appreciate knowing about it, but I'm not sure. I got at least one phone call about it so far, and I'm sure I wasn't the only one. And I referred everything to DRPT.
Well, in this instance, given the strategic importance of it, the governor has taken this process and basically made a recommendation back to the region. And the choice is this. If there is to be an intermodal facility in Virginia, this is the only location that can function and work.
Mr. Chairman, I wasn't joking when I said, have we done everything we, CTB, could do to help move it to completion, and if not, I think we should consider it. And I don't know what else we might could do or what our role is beyond what has already been done, but if there is something that remains to be done, we should do our part.
Well,
Is a resolution appropriate or something?
I might turn to Mr. Martin, who's a little closer. I don't want to put you on the spot, Mr. Martin, but you're a little bit closer to the situation. Are there things that this body could be doing?
Well, in the strictest sense, we, not 2 or 3 years ago, did what we could do. We had a workshop presentation here. We went into great detail about what was expected, what the obligation of Norfolk Southern would be, what our obligation would be. It appears to me that Norfolk Southern and DRPT have done their part, lived up to all they were expected or asked to live up to at that time. Now, if I understand the legalese correctly, the selection of the site technically could go fully to Norfolk Southern. To their credit, it appears that they have chosen to take the high road and work with the state and the CTB, DRPT, out of deference to the popular opinion of a, I say with no value judgment, of a very small number of affected people. Now, that again, that does not diminish those people's opinion. It is a matter, though, that the region and the state have not been the reason for the delay or the pause, as far as I can tell. The pause does seem to be coming out of deference to a small part of a magisterial district in Montgomery County. And I'm not prepared to go into judging one way or the other whether we should or should not do that. I say that to make the point that this board apparently has already done all it can do other than ask questions, be supportive or not supportive if we get new data to make us question that maybe we should do something different.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Tucker, the last comments that you made, you said it would take how many trucks off the road?
150,000 in a steady state of operations on an annual basis.
150,000.
If you look at it, we calculated at 1.9 million trucks over a 15-year period, 189 million gallons of fuel saved over a 15-year period as well.
And you mentioned something about the cost of that. And then if it didn't happen?
If the Commonwealth's investment is protected through the contractual agreement that we have executed with Norfolk Southern. The rail enhancement fund is premised not on us purchasing or acquiring capital assets. It's us acquiring public benefits. So, and as a matter of us acquiring public benefits, all of our grantees contract to produce a performance. And the performance for Norfolk Southern is the 150,000 trucks taken off the containers taken off the road. And if they don't do meet that performance, they have to pay us back our investment plus interest.
That's what I wanted to hear.
One thing that DRPT has done, has everyone received a copy of the analysis?
So.
If you're interested, there's very extensive analysis of the location and impacts of the 10 alternatives and then the 3 detailed cost comparisons and engineering comparisons. But I think it's safe to say, even setting aside money, it's the operational characteristics that determine what will work and what will not work. And there is only one site that will work and not block rail lines for extended periods of time. Okay, let's move to the next item. We do have a work session beginning right at 5, so it is approximately 10 minutes to 4, and we'll suspend at 4 to 5 so we can do appropriate setup. This obviously is our most important work of the year, which is the 6-year program. If there are additional questions and we run out of time here, we can continue the work session to tomorrow morning if necessary. I think, though, for those of us who have been through these exercises, unfortunately, cutting is a whole lot easier than adding, or subtraction is a whole lot easier than addition. And that is the essence of the six-year program, is going to be about subtraction as opposed to addition. So
thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. As the Secretary indicated, I'll provide highlights today of the 2009 through 2014 six-year financial plan and the working draft of the six-year improvement program. I'll start with the financial plan. The official estimated revenues and allocation assumptions for the 2009 through 2014 financial plan is $26.7 billion. Now, keep in mind that this does include the $1.1 billion less in state HMOF and TTS funding from just a year ago. The six-year plan determines the funding available for allocation in the six-year improvement program for rail, transit, ports, aviation, and highways. The 2009 allocations themselves service the budget for both DRPT and VDOT. The Code of Virginia requires the Commonwealth Transportation Board as its first priority to maintain existing transportation assets to ensure safety of the traveling public, also to allocate funds according to formula for construction on the interstate, primary, secondary, and urban state highway systems. Review and comment on budget items not specifically enumerated to the CTB by statute, and to set aside defined portions of the TTS for the Commonwealth Port Fund, the Commonwealth Airport Fund, and the Commonwealth Mass Transit Fund. And just as a quick reminder, of the TTF, the highway percentage is 78.7%, transit is 14.7%, ports 4.2%, and airports 2.4%. So as I indicated, the $26.7 billion is available for allocation and again reflects the $1.1 billion reduction, which was derived from the loss of the abusive driver fees and also the slowdown in the economy that impacted the forecast for sales tax, motor vehicle sales tax, and gas tax revenues. The federal revenue growth, which we had deemed to be approximately flat, was in fact 1.61% increase based upon the growth rate of taxable gallons. One of the things that I would like to stress is we have a continuing concern regarding the long-term viability of federal funding. As you know, Safety Lou will expire at the end of the federal fiscal year 2009. Based on information provided by the Treasury Department, the highway program faces a serious funding crisis in the near term. As a matter of fact, they're forecasting a shortfall of $4.3 billion in 2009. So developing the next transportation legislation at the federal level will be difficult, especially with the new administration, the first session of a new Congress, and then the funding issues that they're facing. So the level of future federal funding is uncertain in light of the economy and disturbing in light of the reduced state economy and our local revenues. The next slide shows in total the revenues for the Commonwealth Transportation Fund. It shows the two prior years, 2007-2008, and it shows the 9 through 14 and includes all the transportation revenues, HMOF, the TTS, and shows percentage changes. This is the What you'll see for 2009 is $4.5 billion, 2010 approximately $4.4 billion, 2011 $4.3 billion, and the State Department of Taxation is determining that in 2012 there's going to be a recovery, an economic recovery, and we'll feel the slight impact of that with a small rising in the revenues from to 4.4, 4.5, and 4.6 in 2012 through 14.
That's interesting. So the account was right. We didn't have to make it, correct?
This next slide shows the proposed allocations of those revenue sources. As you are probably very familiar and have seen before, the allocations are in the categories of debt service, other agency transfers, highway maintenance and operations, tolls, admin, and other programs, public transportation and rail, ports and aviation, earmarks, special financing, and then the highway system construction. And again, this equals the 4.4, approximately the 4.5, the 4.4, the 4.3, et cetera, through 2014.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask a question at this point? Once upon a time, I recall that our debt service was decreasing each year. And this seems to show it increasing almost every year. Is there particular reason for that?
The House Bill 3202 authorized a $3 billion bond, roughly $300 million annual issuance, and so there's escalating debt service over time.
Okay, thank you.
We felt the use of those bonds into the program as our state match to the federal bond.
Mr. Chairman, the line item on earmarks and special financing, is all of that federal earmarks, or are there other, the special financing? What I'm trying to do is separate the two. Because the federal earmarks would be for construction programs, presumably.
Earmarks and special financing, those categories include any undistributed bridge funds, which is federal, revenue sharing, safety funds, RSTP and CMAC. Any undistributed dollars in those areas, and the CPR statewide and regional bond projects.
So,
at this point,
what we commonly refer to as federal earmarks in the federal legislation, is that in this line item as well?
Yes, okay. It is.
All right. So, those two line items together really constitute construction funds, do they not?
Yes,
thank you.
There is some transit mixed in, but it's predominantly highway. And I think another way to think about earmarks and special financing are those that decisions that are made by somebody else.
Yeah.
Could be a local government, could be an MPO, could be Congress.
That's an excellent comment. The next slide is just a graphical depiction of the information that was provided on the previous slide. These allocations by category totaled the $26.7 billion, and you'll see highway maintenance and operations at 42%, and highway systems construction at 14%. We have the same spending priorities this year as we've had in the past. Debt service includes the new debt authorization, as we mentioned a minute ago, which accounts for the 7% of the total funding. The maintenance represents the 42% of the total budget and includes both VDOT maintenance and city and county highway maintenance payments. There's an approximate 4% growth rate in fiscal year 2009 through 14 per year for maintenance costs. In 2009, that equates to the $63 million. Now, that's VDOT's maintenance and the localities payments. when you look at that through 2014, at the rate of 4%, highway maintenance will increase by approximately $415 million to approximately $450 million, or a cumulative of $1.4 billion over the 6 years. And the only growth in programs outside of the maintenance and construction are for legislatively approved pay increases and related benefits. This slide is a good way of sort of showing the federal share of construction. The federal share of systems construction averages 58% in this draft. Last year it was approximately 52%. And the federal share for the secondary and urban state formula allocations averages 23%, and it averaged 15% in the last program. I said last year, the last six-year program.
This, by the way, is what we call a canary in the coal mine. A federal share of 80%, which is the maximum, means that you have no flexibility whatsoever, and you probably couldn't even get there in reality. But once you're beyond a 50% share of federal dollars in your program, and you'll see over time that that share increases, you're starting to head for problems. And you've seen in the long-range forecast, I think it's in 2017, 2018, actually 2016 is when it starts, the inability to match federal dollars.
That's right.
And so this rising share, some people say, boy, that's great, the feds are paying more. In fact, it is a sign of a fiscal and strategic weakness.
Jim, one more question, and this is a serious question. I know some people are going to laugh, but I know we can't probably do it now, but because it's so recent. But I would be interested in knowing the impact of Senator McCain's proposal to Congress for a moratorium on the federal gasoline tax from Memorial Day to Labor Day. I'm sure that question is being asked in all 50 states as to what effect that would have on our highway construction program and on our maintenance program. So maybe at the May meeting, if we could look at something like that.
Certainly.
Maybe
we'll
you've
bring
got
that
something
back to you.
Mr. Chairman, Ken, we've got, I got a flash from our association this morning, so I can give you their first cut at the analysis of that impact on the program, and I'll get that forwarded to the board yet tonight.
Right. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I could add, it's not simply that we lose our flexibility administering a program. We increasing reliance on something that, in fact, has growing uncertainty. So the federal program's uncertainties are as large, if not larger, than those in our own state. And it's exactly the opposite way you would usually respond to risk.
The 2009 through 2014 six-year improvement program for highways allocates available funding to specific projects in the amount of $7.74 billion. $5.31 billion is for the projects on the interstate, primary, secondary, and urban systems. The difference of $2.4 billion between the 7.7 and the 5.3 is attributed to the federal, about approximately $1 billion in federal funding for maintenance and operations, approximately $870 million for RSTP, CMAC, and safety dollars, approximately $128 million for the enhancement program, and $150 million for statewide access management and operational improvements. Because the primary, secondary, and urban construction projects are the last items to be funded, they have been, as you know, the most affected by the revenue swings and increased costs. This is just, again, a graphical depiction of the dollars as they break down by system. Now I wanted to give you a little bit of a summary of the projects that, or what we've been able to do in the six-year program by system. This first slide shows that we've been able to fund 49 existing interstate projects for completion 9 through 14. So in the different districts, these are the number of projects that based on schedules and estimates, can be completed during that six-year time frame. The next slide shows that 25 existing primary project phases were cut from the draft, and the phase counts are listed by district here on the side. And again, this is due to the funding reduction.
Chairman, a question. Would it be safe to say we cut the more expensive ones and we're completing on the previous slide probably some of the less expensive?
I would say that's a fair statement.
I might note, though, that I think this slide deals with the primary system, both the interstate system, or is it?
The previous one was the interstate. This is primary.
The phases that we're cutting here. In essence, if I interpreted that first slide right, we're fully funding the projects scheduled for the interstate system.
Interstate funding was federal funding, and it was level, yes.
And these 25 existing primary system project phases, so it's on the primary system, not the interstate.
That's correct.
All right.
That's correct. Now, the next slide, though, does show that we'll be able to advertise 114 primary projects for construction during the six-year program. And again, we show the numbers by district. These projects are listed in your notebooks in the front, on the very front. Yes. And so you'll be able to see by district those projects that I'm referring to here.
So the shorthand way of saying it is really good news is contained in the pocket of your envelope, of your...
Yes, you know, I'm sorry. I couldn't think of the word pocket to save my life. It's in the front of your notebook, in the pocket.
So it's what now?
What you have are the list, and they're organized...
By system.
By system.
Lynchburg and Salem, but the color coding is pretty simple. If it's green, the project is a go. If it's yellow, the project is being delayed. If it is red, the project is being cut and never foreseeable future not going to happen. And included in that list are critical bridge replacement projects that will not happen. And also included in that list are the candidate projects. And for you, for the hearing this evening, I think these are these illustrate again the impacts by color, by district, and these will be available for the public hearing.
One thing I do
want to
say is, if you're
local,
you have lived in secondary
And we are providing the map and additional information for each of the public hearings, updated information as we go through the six hearings. Monday, we will have Bristol, information for the Bristol public hearing. As the slide shows, when you look at the list that you're now, you have in your hand, the bigger hits are being taken in the secondary system. You have approximately 224 delayed projects and 174 projects that are looking to be cut or eliminated. And again, we have those slides of those. And the last slide is the depiction of the delayed urban projects by district. And again, the secondary and urban projects are evolving as the localities update those for us. But this is a picture of where we are at this point.
Chairman, you are stating that you have notified all of the localities of the cuts of what needs, and they are to respond back to you.
They are responding as they normally would to what they're programming. Because of the cuts, I think in some cases kind of gone back to the drawing board and made some attempts based on discussions with the residencies and the urban program managers what makes the best sense to use the remaining dollars in terms of the project. So there has been a little extra effort, I believe, on the parts of the localities working with us to make sense of where the dollars will serve better for.
That's a good thing, that the localities have the input. Thank you so much.
Just to wrap this part of the presentation up, we do have six hearings, the first one being tonight and the next one being Monday night. We will bring back a final program once we get everyone's information. We have been getting feedback from the districts and the board members on the draft interstate and primary systems, and we'll be updating and programming the secondary and urban as we go. So we will present the final to the board for adoption June 19th.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to commend Ms. Busher and her staff for a very difficult job that they've done, I think, very well. I'd be in trouble with my constituents if I said the results are good. I think they're less bad than they could have been.
Yes, thank you. And the staff gets the credit. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Member Bowie, I appreciate the comment. As we went through the process this year, and admittedly we're still in process, but last year we took very seriously the concerns of the board about improving the communication patterns that we've had. Each of the districts this year has identified a single point of contact to work with Ms. Busher's staff. We think that's helped. The district administrators are engaged very heavily in the process this year and have been helping significantly set and establish priorities. That part of the process is working for us. The next piece that I promised you was a thinner notebook. The Secretary has signed the memorandums of agreement with the Federal Highway Administration and the Federal Transit Administration that will allow that to occur in future years. That's why I could not deliver it to you this year. That document will have an extreme impact on how we do business, and it will streamline for MPOs and others how they have to go through the amendment process. So I'm really encouraged about what I see happening with the program development process, regardless of the result. The process is getting better.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to commend the commissioner on the work that he and his staff have done. One who complained a fair amount last year about the process and the lack of communication. I think this year is a totally different experience, and I'm mighty glad to hear that the memorandum of agreement produced a thinner document is now been signed.
Mr. Chairman, I'd add to that. Because I remember last June, several people spoke up about the process and how it might be improved, and it has definitely been improved this year, especially given the tight financial straits we're in. I think the emphasis on finding projects and putting money on things that could be done sooner, pouring pavement, concrete, getting things done, at least in my district, we did that. The district administrator and I had a very good meeting of the minds about how to move projects to construction as a priority. I'd liken it to pushing a handful of rocks up the tough mountain instead of 100 of them simultaneously, not going very far. And I think in that respect, this is a big improvement.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to echo some of what I've heard. I mean, just casual look through here under the required after 2014, there's a lot of zeros. In other words, we're going to fully fund fewer projects. I mean, we don't have, you know, it's a tight fiscal year, but we're going to fully fund them and get things moving. And I think that that's commendable because that's what we need to see happen to get things moving.
Mr. Chairman, this makes our work not only easier but more transparent. The information is presented in a very usable form. The question I always get is, what's off the list as opposed to what's on? It's almost like you bring your report card home, which piece do you want to look at first? The second thing is I think it makes it more transparent for the public, and ultimately that's our responsibility too. I think the more information, the more understanding the public has about the difficulty of trying to fund a program when the funds are like a light switch off and on, will work to advantage in the long term. And so I think this both improves the transparency, potentially the responsiveness, and certainly the accountability, and I appreciate it very much.
Any other comments? Can I add just one thing? And I said this publicly during a speech up at VMI a couple of weeks ago, citing the VDOT six-year planning process in two respects. One, the Pew Center for the States has identified VDOT as a real star program for the work it does in the planning process and with the dashboard, and its remarkable improvement up into the 90 percentiles for on time and on budget. And I am trying to start a conversation in the natural resources area that for capital improvements such as sewage treatment plants and park acquisitions and wildlife management areas, things that require huge chunks of money to do, that they ought to look to VDOT's six-year plan as a model for how to do that kind of thing. So, frankly, I hope you will encourage your counterpart in that direction, because I think this really does work. And there isn't any other part of state government, I don't believe, that does it as well. And more transparently to produce real results on the ground. And that is, after all, what the public wants when they're handing us tax money to allocate. And so I just want to say that for all the grief that we sometimes encounter discussing this process, it's actually quite good compared to everything else I know in the government.
Mr. Chairman, I think Jerry's on to something there, and I would just add to it, it's interesting that out of this state, outside the state, we get all types of recognition for the improvements we've made. And sometimes within the state itself, even in our own bodies that are supposed to be passing some of these guidelines, they seem to want to criticize VDOT and CTB in those areas and say that we need to do better with what we've got instead of actually having more resources to work with. And I would challenge that particular train of thought with a review of everything that's happened since 2002. When you go back in the mess that we've done and the continuous changes that's been made through the years. And this is just another part of the layer of the cake with icing on it to see continued improvements along these lines. So I think it's time we get some of this recognition within the state as well as those from outside who lay the accolades on us.
Congratulations, Commissioner. Ms. Busher.
Thank you. I want to thank you for your comments, and I want to thank my staff for doing such a good job and teaching me along the way. Thank you.
May I add to that, please, sir? Your staff is wonderful. They really, really are. And I go to many meetings. They are there.
Yeah.
And you call them on the phone, and you also. And they, could you come to my locality? Yes. We haven't had an opportunity to do all of this, but they are wonderful.
Important issue, just on this, I believe it was Mr. Poole, they said, you know, what's not on the list? And I think these gaps are very, very important. Now, we only have them for the two districts, but it's important that we not focus just on the green lights, but also the yellow lights, and importantly, the red lights. When you see the red lights, those are the priorities. We do have a prioritization process in place that we've taken candidate projects out to hearing. So those are things that are not on that list. They're the critical bridge replacement. They're not on the list. There are projects that were in the future program last year that are not on the list. And so, again, that's part of transparency. And it's important that we not focus just on green, but that we focus on yellow and red as well, because that is the next step in the process of improvement.
May I add one further thing, Mr. Chairman? It's difficult. I mean, it's nobody's fault when revenues fall in any given year. It is somebody's fault if the system doesn't respond to the larger question of the inadequacy of the funding mechanisms we're using. You can see them changing. You can see their inadequacies over time. And to ignore that year after year is irresponsible. But what I would also say is some of you have the difficulty of having projects from in your district canceled or delayed, and Northern Virginia certainly has that. But we also, due to the way that our regional solution was constructed and didn't survive a court challenge, we've lost as well the regional component of what was supposed to be a complementary effort of the region. So, you know, this is really devastating to Northern Virginia, and I would just say for the record that I expect there to be a fairly loud voice on this set of issues. The governor did get a number of questions about this at his town hall meeting Saturday in Northern Virginia, and I think probably the Northern Virginia community is going to be looking for allies around the state for a much more ambitious and much more comprehensive solution than some have proposed. So I'm encouraged that my expectation is the governor will have a pretty ambitious proposal and that others from Northern Virginia will have similarly ambitious aims. And I think it may be a time to think that way about it. We need a comprehensive solution to this financing and revenue problem, not just a smaller hole in the bucket.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I'm going to, if we just do this in 10 seconds, because we've got to start public hearing at 5 o'clock.
I will do it. It'll be very brief. I find myself agreeing with Mr. Coulomb today on several points, and that's why. But I just want to piggyback on what you said. This district has no interstate highways, and that's always created a funding issue. We heard earlier that interstate funds are level, but primary funds are down 44%. So our district as well looks to a statewide solution, and we're very, very anxious to hear what the governor is going to propose. That took maybe 12 seconds.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Badger, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, members of the board. I'm going to give you a brief presentation of what you'll find in the rail and public transportation section of the six-year improvement program. Today, I want to give you a brief funding overview, talk about what you'll find in the rail and public transportation sections of the program. For public transportation, we do have a new FTA, Federal Transit Administration program, that I'll touch on briefly. And there's a number of special provisions in the Appropriations Act that I need to go over with you because they're going to have some impacts on our program. Finally, I just want to describe what you'll find when you turn to our section of the green book that you have in front of you. As you've heard, revenue forecasts are down. Public transportation, the course transportation trust fund component of that is down at the same rates that the highway fund is down. We also received state recordation fees. That's to fund the new component of our transit operating program. Those have dropped considerably. Overall, transit revenues are down by about 8% during the six-year period. On the good news front, rail program revenue estimates did not decline. The Rail Enhancement Fund receives money from rental car tax fees, and they did not predict, at the last go-around at least, that the revenues from that source would change. So those have held constant. I thought I would throw this in just to show you how far we've come. This shows how much state money was provided for rail and public transportation back when our agency was created in fiscal year 93 and where it is today. You can see it's about a 229% increase. So there's been real growth in state investments in both rail and public transportation. Talking briefly about the rail program, we have $26 million in rail enhancement funds. That we've divided up among 15 projects. These are primarily construction projects, some engineering, and one environmental study. We have 13 projects in the Rail Preservation Fund for our short line railroads. That's annual allocation of that is $3 million. And mixed in among both the Rail Enhancement Fund projects and the short line projects is $13 million in rail bond funds. This is the outlook for rail capital funding. You can see in fiscal year 08, we had a special appropriation of $65 million that provided a one-time surge of funding for the rail enhancement program. On this chart, the bottom portion of the bars in green is rail preservation. That holds constant at about $3 million a year. Blue is the rail enhancement fund. And then the gold on the top are the rail bond funds. So you can see we expect a modest growth and rail capital funding over the next 6 years. Moving on to the public transportation program, the first thing I need to touch on is one of the new provisions in the Appropriations Act. There is an item that dictates that the Commonwealth Transportation Board can allocate up to 3% of the revenues for rail and public transportation to support project development, project administration, and project compliance activities of our agency. This provision was put in the governor's budget in recognition that the responsibilities and initiatives of our agencies have grown considerably in recent years and that we need more revenues to perform our work. Our current source of agency administrative funds, as you see up there, is the HMO fund. And as you know, that's severely strained. We believe that it makes sense to use rail and transit funds to support new rail and transit initiatives of our agency. So in June, we're going to ask you to allocate a small percentage of rail and transit revenues to allow us to perform certain key activities that support our rail and public transportation programs. In the draft program, we've set aside 2.6%, as you see there. We're still working on this, and in the final program, you will likely see a different number, and we expect it will be a lower number. We are sharpening our pencils and trying to only put the activities in our list that we really think are essential. The new Federal Transit Administration program that we're awarding grants to this year is called the New Freedom Program. This program provides grants to support projects that expand the mobility options for disabled people in Virginia. The amount of money that we have for the program is not very large, but these are very important projects. There are a lot of federal rules that go with this program. One of the requirements was that we had to conduct what they call regional coordination plans all across the state. They didn't give us the guidelines for doing those plans until last spring, so consequently we did not complete the regional plans until late winter, early spring this year, so we did not get a whole lot of grant applications for this program. We anticipate going back out, or we intend to go back out and have a second solicitation of grant applications for this, and we expect that we'll get a much better response the second time around. Closely associated with that, the paratransit capital program that we've had for a number of years was expanded. The amount of money went from $800,000 up to $1.5 million, and the eligible uses of the program was changed. We now can do the paratransit capital projects as we always have, and we can also use these funds to provide enhanced transportation services for the elderly and disabled. These funds will be used to match the new Freedom Program and to do our paratransit capital program. And at the same time, we solicit applications for the new Freedom Program. We'll be getting applications for these funds as well. The second provision of the Appropriations Act is a clause that indicates we are to go ahead and start using maintenance of effort. I mentioned this to you last year when we talked about the new state funds we were going to have for transit operating. We did see about a $30 million increase this year with the first year recordation taxes going into the transit operating fund. We thought it was important that we make sure that the new funds that we get don't simply supplant local funds. We want to see the funds spent for new services, expanded services, or for helping absorb the cost increase the public transportation systems are strapped with. This is an example of how it'll work. On the top line, this is the operating budget for a transit agency with a total budget of about $2.7 million. You can see how in FY08, the operating revenues and federal and state and local aid made up that $2.7 million. The same transit system coming in for an application in fiscal year 09. The costs have gone up. If we ran it straight through our formula, you'd see in the first line below the heavy black line, that the far right-hand column, the local money required to support the budget would be $235,000. What we're saying is that, no, that's less than you spent last year, so what we will do is we'll trim the state grant back to the point where they will spend as much in fiscal year 09 as they did in fiscal year 08. Now, they still get an increase, a nice increase in state aid, but we're going to require the local investment to remain at least level from the previous fiscal year. This is how public transportation operating funding looks for the year. This is the total expenses for transit operating in fiscal year 08 and fiscal year 09, and how it's supported with operating revenues in blue at the bottom, federal aid, yellow, and second bar up. State aid is a green, and on the top is the local funds that support transit. You can see how it breaks down percentage-wise between the two fiscal years. Overall, operating expenses went up by 11% in 09 from 08. That's the same rate of increase we saw the previous year.
Thank you.
Operating revenues are up, but they're only up by about 6%. So we're getting more ridership, and some of them had some fare increases, but it's not keeping up with the general growth in costs. I want to do focus on the $135 million you see there in state funds. Our state funds can't be used for everything in the transit system's operating budget. By law, we're restricted to providing state aid to support administrative expenses and fuel, tires, and maintenance expenses. So on this next slide, I want to take the $692 million number and put it in a slightly different format. Here I've shown the breakdown between eligible expenses and ineligible. On this bar, the $287 million in red, those are the eligible expenses. Everything in the gray and black is ineligible. Taking those same revenue sources that I just showed you, our $135 million in the green, the state aid, supports 45% of those eligible expenses. The balance of 55% is supported in local funds. So that's where we talk about the state match for eligible expenses. This year it's 45%, last year it was 42%. So there has been an increase, but not as much as you might think, because costs have gone up pretty considerably. On the capital program, this is a comparison of last year's capital program versus the coming years. It's lower this year, primarily because in 08 we had a lot of general fund money that was put into the capital program to pay for some special initiatives that don't occur again in FY09. also because the Hampton Roads Light Rail Project was much more heavily funded in FY08 than it is in FY09. So you can see the overall expenses have dropped by, I believe, it's current here, by about $88 million. Federal money dropped as well, mostly that, again, that's the light rail light rail funding for Hampton Roads. The state funds are about $100 million. Overall, we're going to be providing 28% of the total cost, and local governments will be providing 14% of the total cost. And we often refer to a state share, and when we talk about the state share, we really only talk about the non-federal portion. So I've prepared one other slide. It shows you how this breaks out. If you ignore the federal funds, which are in gray, and look strictly at the state-local breakdown, you'll see that in fiscal year 08, our $134 million provided 66% of the non-federal share. In fiscal year 09, our $100 million, once again, is going to support 66%. So even though our money is, state funds are lower, we're going to be supporting transit at the same level that we did in the previous fiscal year. This is an overview of the capital projects. Of course, we have our perennial heavy hitters, the WMATA Metro Rail project. By the way, these are total costs. This includes federal, state, and local money. The light rail project is in here for the last time. We're going to complete our funding for the Hampton Roads light rail project this year. Going on down the list, you see that we're going to be purchasing 140 replacement buses and vans and 45 expansion buses and vans. So like most years, most of the purchases we see are for replacement equipment with some service expansion. And last year we used bond funding for the first time at $20 million. This year it's gone up to $60 million. These are the guidelines that we're using to decide which projects get which source of state money. The bond funds are provided at an 80% state match. And the regular state aid to public transportation, the $32 million, is the floating state match that we talk about every year. The items that are eligible for bond funds are generally those that are a clearly identifiable asset with significant useful life. It's easier to describe what's not eligible, and that's for things like debt service, shop equipment, office equipment that doesn't have particularly long useful life, software, preventative maintenance, spare parts, those kinds of expenses. The bond funds will support projects at 80% of the non-federal share, and the mass transit trust funds will support projects at a 50% state share. Here's the outlook for transit capital. Again, we had special appropriation last year, which boosted our investment pretty significantly. The bond funds increased this year up to $60 million, so it makes up a fair amount of the gap that we lost when we didn't get the general funds again. Overall, there's some modest growth in the transit capital program. We do have 1 year in which the bond funds go down. I believe that has to do with the amount of bonds that will be sold overall. On the operating side, this is the funding outlook that shows the mass transit trust funds. As you see, in fiscal year 09 is the first year we have the recreation tax funds coming into play. So this year is a good news year for public transportation. Yet at the same time, the costs are growing much more rapidly than the growth you see in our fund here. I believe that's about a 3% growth in the outer years. And as I mentioned, the last 2 years, operating expenses have gone up about 11% per year. Main reason for that, these are the two big drivers in transit operating costs. Diesel fuel has gone up over 300% since fiscal year 04. It was 79 cents a gallon back then, and now in 09 it's projected to be as high as $2.90 a gallon. Another one that you're probably very familiar with is health insurance. That's increased 35% in transit systems in the last 3 years. So the bottom line is, while we do have good news in the operating side, it's still going to be strained as costs for fuel, health insurance, and all these other items continue to outpace the revenues. Turning now to what you find in the big green book you have on your desk, our section starts on page 825, or in the back. I don't know how many pages. I think we're about 50 pages, but these are the major chapters, if you will, of our section of the program. Most of the information that you'll probably find of interest is in the second one, and that's public transportation projects by district. This is what it looks like. This is the Danville grant for the year. In the district section, you'll find every transit system listed individually. Likewise, our human service transportation programs that get grants are in there. Our planning district grants are in there. And you'll see exactly what it is we're purchasing and where the money's coming from. The rail projects are not in this section this year. I think we're going to try to put them in next year. The rail enhancement funds and the rail preservation projects are listed at the end of the statewide summaries and towards the back of the program. In closing, I need to go back to one other item in the Appropriations Act language that is significant. I've already gone over the portion in black. The portion in black has to do with maintenance of effort. But this line item contains something else that's very significant. As you can see in red, this language in the Act states that we, DRPT, are to incorporate the principles of maintenance of effort, trans-sustainability, public benefit, and asset management into how we conduct our business and how we award grants. And it tells us that we're to do this by next year. We're already well underway with this. You've heard us talk about our public benefit work and asset management work. We'll be giving you a report on this next month. And, in fact, in your book today, we have a draft policy that we'd like you to start taking a look at. It sets out what we believe are the principles that should direct us as we award grants in the future and hits on each one of these categories. We ask you to take a look at that. We'll give you a presentation on this in May, and then we'll actually ask you to adopt a resolution in June that will formalize our commitment to incorporating these principles into our program. In closing, I want to remind you that, as I did last year, I'll be contacting each one of you individually to offer you the opportunity to sit down and go over these projects, ask any questions that you might have, and get any additional information that you would like to see. We've had a couple of meetings already, but I will be contacting the rest of you in the very near future. And with that, I'll be happy to take any questions.
So we'll just have about 1 minute before we have to shut down so we can set up for the public hearing. Are there any urgent or burning questions? I know Mr. Badger and Mr. Tucker can be available in the back room if you have any questions. What I'm going to recommend that we do, are there any major questions right now? What we will do is we'll suspend the work session. We'll pick that up first thing tomorrow morning. Chip, we'll start with you. If you have questions now, just will you be here?
Yes, I will.
Morning? Okay. And then Connie Sorrell can do the 6-year maintenance budget. Again, we've been working for many years to get to a 6-year maintenance and operations budget. That's a big, very important, actually the biggest piece of funding that we do in this body. So that's very important. So with that, we're going to recess the work session until 11:00.